TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Rupert Reed, this civilization is finished. So what is to be done? Rupert Reed is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia, UK, and is a longtime Green Party politician and one of the spokespeople for Extinction Rebellion. In October 2019, the global movement of Extinction Rebellion that started in the UK will be 1 year young. They credit the experiences of Gandhi, the US civil rights movement, the school strikes of high school students, and carefully designed their goals and strategy. On their website, rebellion.earth, they say that we are facing an unprecedented global climate emergency. The government has failed to protect us, and we are using civil disobedience and nonviolent resistance to protest against climate breakdown, biodiversity loss, and the risk of social and ecological collapse. End quote. One of their strategies is for speakers such as Rupert Reed to travel across the country and lay out the signs of climate change and what role people can assume to prevent or mitigate climate disaster. In part one of his talk, Rupert Reed explained why, in his opinion, the Paris Climate Agreement has failed, in spite of the extraordinary fact that all but one country, the U.S., are part of it. In response to that failure, he suggested three scenarios. Possibility one, transform civilization radically by relocalizing, changing agriculture and eating habits, etc. But Rupert Reed said, it is too remote a chance to bet on it. It would mean turning around the entire supertanker of world civilization. A more likely scenario we can hope for is to create a successor civilization after some kind of collapse. Number three, we need to face the possibility of a total collapse. Gaia philosopher James Lovelock talks about a few thousand breeding pairs left in the Antarctic, or complete human extinction. Rupert Reed then goes on to list actions we can take now. The first, wake up to reality. It may involve despair, fear, and sadness. But if you're not sad or afraid, you're not paying attention. Eco-psychology says these feelings are rational, and it is not you who needs fixing, but the world around us. In addition to waking up, we need to build lifeboats through the storms that are coming and preserve things that will be useful to future people, such as seed banks. And we need to build community. Rupert Reed mentions the transition town model. That's a recap of the first half of his talk. And here now is Rupert Reed as he continues with his list of actions we can take, among them deep adaptation, holding action, and rebellion.
There's another phrase which has started to be used in this connection, which I think is also very useful. People are talking about deep adaptation. And deep adaptation means adaptation which is actually specifically premised on the thought that collapse is likely. Deep adaptation considers the thought, what if we fail? What if we really do fail and things start to collapse? We need to be, for example, preparing for sea level rise and not doing completely absurd things, such as building nuclear power stations by the seaside, which is where virtually all nuclear power stations are and are built. An absolute definition of insanity at this moment in history, to build these things which are toxic for hundreds of years, highly toxic for hundreds of years, in places where they're vulnerable to something which we know is extremely likely to be coming. And if civilization does partially even collapse, How confident are you that all the kind of resources that are needed to keep those nuclear power plants safe are going to remain intact? We've already seen at Fukushima a little bit of what can happen even in the middle of an intact civilization when something hits a nuclear power station. Remember that there are going to definitely be more natural disasters. Of course, we can't really use that word natural disasters anymore because they're partly man-made, most of them now. There are definitely going to be more natural disasters. There are definitely going to be climate disasters coming in the next generation. There's a slight chance that we might be able to transform to stop climate catastrophe, but there will definitely be more climate disasters, as we're seeing right now. Building nuclear power stations in the context of that, it is absolutely absurd. The deep adaptation agenda also is another reason for thinking that there's something very wrong about the ambition of geoengineering. Because to geoengineer, to have this incredibly hubristic idea of we're going to control, humanity is going to control the climate of the whole Earth, you have to have a technological infrastructure which you are confident you can support for the long run, right? So imagine, for example, if we put a load of mirrors in space, which is what some of the fantasists want to do, to deflect away sunlight so that we can beat some of the effects of global overheating. We have to be able to be confident that those mirrors will be able to stay up there for a very, very long time. And in fact, actually, many of the proposals for mirrors in space are not literally mirrors. There are lots of very, very small particles that you put up there, and then they start to fall down again, and then you put more up there. Well, what would happen if you had a project like that, and then suddenly you weren't able to put them up there anymore because the country that's supposed to do that has collapsed? Then you could get a sudden spiking in temperature, which is far worse than a gradual increase in temperature. Or think of some of the other potential side effects from geoengineering. People want to seed the oceans with iron and other stuff to create plankton blooms that will then sink to the bottom and can be sequestered and that kind of thing. We don't know what the effects of that are going to be. If we are on top of our game, you know, maybe we can monitor those and then do interventions to counter the horrible negative side effects quite like to happen from an intervention like that. But we can't do any of that if the civilization in question has collapsed. And you might then get some kind of vast oceanic dead zone opening up and nothing human beings can do about it. One of the morals here is that there are worse things that could happen than civilizational collapse. And I think as humans, we're quite bad at thinking that thought. But what could be worse than our civilization collapsing? Well, here's something that could be worse. If our civilization collapses in a really horrific, uncontrolled way and poisons the remaining ecosystems at the same time, right? So be very careful what you wish for. The deep adaptation agenda says we need to be thinking and acting now in ways that take seriously into account the possibility that we will not be able to do the kinds of interventions in future that we can do now. Holding actions. This is a term from Joanna Macy. What does she mean by this? She means actions to hold the damage at bay and slow it down, buy ourselves more time. What kind of things come under this heading? Well, again, a wide variety of things. Everything from consumer boycotts to divestment campaigns. You know, obviously, Cambridge University must divest from fossil fuels to political action, lobbying, getting involved in electoral politics. Don't make the mistake of thinking that because I'm saying that civilizational collapse in some form or another is likely to happen, that we should give up on these conventional methods. Not at all. They're still absolutely vital right now. It's just that they're not enough by themselves anymore. We should think of them primarily as holding actions, as holding back the potential catastrophe. I would also throw in here, obviously, given my perspective, that I would urge you all to not just vote Green, but to join the Green Party. So holding actions are a vital part of what we need to do. Sixth point, holding actions are not enough. We should rebel. That's why I've distributed these Extinction Rebellion leaflets around the room. These guys, who I've just joined with recently, very, very impressive. They're saying, look, this is an emergency. It is incredibly urgent. It is going to determine our futures. The governments have completely failed us. We should not any longer accept their authority. It's not enough to do consumer boycotts and vote and so on. We should do nonviolent direct action as well. And I think they're exactly right. I'm reminded a little bit of the marvelous film series that some of you will be familiar with, the Hunger Games trilogy. The second of those films was called Catching Fire. And the idea there was that some small gestures of disobedience and defiance can create a spark that catches light and can ignite a much, much larger rebellion. Now, I'm not talking about us doing the kind of things that people did in the Hunger Games films. Thankfully, our scenario is not quite as horrific as the scenario those fictional characters were living under. But the potential future that we're facing is pretty much as horrific as theirs. And so it seems to me that the least we can do is rebel through non-violent direct action, as the Extinction Rebellion marvellously are doing. One little side note on that. People sometimes say to me, oh, Rupert, you talk too much in terms that are kind of fearful, and you make people sad and scared, and you don't give them enough hope. And my reply is, well, I don't think that this is really a time where hope is the most appropriate emotion to feel. What we need right now is courage. What we need right now is courage to face the reality and to try to do the right thing in the face of it. And that is what the Extinction Rebellion people are showing. They're showing real courage, a willingness to put their bodies on the line, etc. And if enough of us manage to do that, we could change the course of history. And we could bring about, conceivably, this transformed civilization, which I mentioned earlier, and which, of course, must be a much more hopeful idea than the success of civilization after collapse. Do I think it's likely to succeed, the Extinction Rebellion? No. Do I think it might succeed? Yes. And that's the wonderful thing about human action in the future. One can never know what's going to work and what isn't. I wouldn't bet on it succeeding, but I would like to throw myself into trying to make it succeed. And the more of us who are brave enough to do that, the more chance that it might just succeed. And even if it doesn't succeed, it will at least have shown some courage and some willingness to look what's coming in the face. And that brings me to the seventh and final thing on my list. We need to stop. What do I mean by that? So I'm encouraging you to do all these things, join the Green Party, rebel, wake up, talk about this and so on. But there's something else as well. We need to stop. We need to slow right down and actually give ourselves a chance to really take all of this in and really think about it and really feel it. If we don't do that, then we won't wake up properly and we won't be in a good position to wake everyone else up. We need to stop and give ourselves time to talk about this and work through issues in relation to it. And only if we stop will we actually be in a good position to do the dramatic, courageous things that we're going to need to do under these headings if there is to be hope emerging from all of this. Paul Kingsnorth, who saw a lot of the way things were going some years ago and was one of the founders of the Dark Mountain group, said the following. He said, "There is an abyss opening up before us. We need to be brave enough to look into it. And only if we do that will we then know what to do next." And that's what I mean by stopping. So I urge you to do these various things. Use your abilities, use your intelligence and your potential in the way that best fits you to them. I would say don't restrict yourself to just one of them, though, that we need to be giving ourselves multiple options. We've gambled too much to date on being able to stop the juggernaut from destroying us. We need to think very seriously about what will happen if we fail, and that's why these are important. But the first thing I want to suggest to you that we need to do is to stop. Give ourselves a chance to reflect on all of this, and only if we do that will we be actually well-placed to make the next moves forward. And now I'm going to stop. I'm going to throw it open to you for questions and discussion, which I think is deeply necessary. Thank you so much for coming here, and thank you for your attention.
That was a really awesome talk. Threw up so much material for debate. I'm just going to ask one question before we get started on the Q&A. I just wanted to ask Rupert whether you could expand a bit more on what you meant by the term civilization collapse.
Do we have any signs of what it looks like already visible to us in the world? Well, I'm afraid that we do. I think you could argue that there are some morbid symptoms in this country and certainly in the United States that point to a kind of the beginnings of a kind of societal disintegration. Much more to the point, look at what's happening in places like the Congo or the Yemen. And bear in mind that, of course, one of the reasons why the conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa and parts of Africa have been as severe as they have been in the last few years is already climate change. and that's only going to get worse. The projections for Africa are frankly, you know, incredibly sad and scary.
Thank you. So does anyone have any questions for Rupert?
I was wondering how you recommend going about talking to people about this, because I've been trying to talk to my family and friends about this for the past few weeks, and I think they're ready to get me sectioned.
Yeah. Okay, so I've tried to model some of it. One thing which I think is quite important is creating some kind of emotional resonance. And that's one of the reasons why I always say something like, I'm afraid for you. And that brings something real into the room, which is not there in most talks around this. When climate scientists talk about this, they hardly ever say anything like that. They feel it's kind of not their role, it's kind of too touchy-feely or something. It's not their expertise. So that's one quite important point I would make. You've got to try to establish some kind of emotional resonance. You've got to also provide an opportunity for discussion. It's really dangerous on this one to do what happens, for example, at some academic conferences, where you have someone give a long lecture and then there's like 5 minutes for questions or something. No. There's got to be a possibility for actually thinking about it and feeling about it kind of together for a while. And I think it's also useful to help people to understand that they're not alone in the way I described. So let me actually ask for a little show of hands at this point. Can I ask you, please put your hand up if you've heard someone give a talk or read a paper or something which has been quite as, well, I would use the term climate realist, others would use the term pessimistic or negative or something. Put your hands up if you've ever heard a talk or read a paper which is as climate realist as this one before. Okay, so a reasonable number of you. Now let me ask you to put your hands up if you've ever kind of thought the kinds of thoughts that are in this talk before. If you've ever thought something like, it seems to me that probably we're going to collapse. Okay, and that's what I thought would happen. At least twice as many people put their hands up. And that tells me, and I hope tells you, that what I'm saying is right, that we've been refusing to talk about this. We've been kind of keeping it a secret and worrying about it by ourselves. And I think that attitude is no longer sustainable, literally. And we need to share it. So to do things like that and to enable people to understand that they're not alone in these fears, I think that's really, really important. I think it's really, really harmful if people are thinking, is it just me? Am I going crazy?
Yeah, you got another question over there.
Thanks, Rupert. You actually, it was terrifying. All I would say is, I think what you said was brilliant, and I think for most of us, though, there's a strange cognitive dissonance, because the way you're talking feels both realistic and utterly incomprehensible simultaneously. Yes. In terms of the sort of lives that we're all leading. And one of the things that I sort of worry about is that you talk about civilization collapsing as if it was one thing. It seems to me that civilization, as you say, if it is one thing, is in serious trouble right now. But the point is that there are a lot of people who are trying to create the impression that there is a version of civilization that will, if you like, ride out all of the changes that you're talking about. And that will be very differentially experienced. And some people might be sitting in this hall in 100 years' time, you know, if you like, in that lifeboat of the luxury and the sort of relative level of privilege of this society, whilst civilization has completely disappeared elsewhere. So that's where what you're talking about gets very political, and trying to understand the practical politics of that.
Yeah.
When you've essentially got a series of regimes now that could honestly be described as enemies of the planet, and they are proliferating.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is partly what you're talking about in Extinction Rebellion and so forth, is that the right response to that? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, look, in terms of Extinction Rebellion, in terms of this leaflet and so on, it's a kind of experiment. I'm quite impressed with it so far. It's early days. I think that something like that, what the Extinction Rebellion are both talking about and trying to do, I mean, in terms of their objectives and in terms of the methods for trying to achieve it, are on the right track if we're going to have any chance of achieving the 1.5 degree ambition. You know, that requires total civilizational transformation very rapidly, going up against huge vested interests, not only going through conventional political and democratic processes. So that's what I would say about that. in terms of your points about sort of the politics of lifeboats and so on, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are very awkward and difficult questions to think about here. I've touched on one of them by talking about does it really make sense to carry on talking about freedom of movement? We should be willing to take some climate refugees potentially in this country, it seems to me. After all, we're the cause of a lot of the trouble. We had the Industrial Revolution first. But we literally don't have much capacity to take very many if it starts to get to the point that I'm afraid it is likely to get to. And at the end of the day, it seems to me there ought to be lifeboats. It would be better for some civilization to survive than for no civilization to survive. But what you need to do, and this is why I'm talking about the importance of thinking civilizational succession, what you need to do is to try to ensure that any way in which you go about creating such lifeboats isn't so repellent and aggressive and immoral and so on as to be kind of self-undermining, or better that it hadn't happened at all. And that's a real challenge. Coming back to your first point about how this is simultaneously kind of climate realism and feels... It's very hard for us for it to feel kind of fully real to us, you know, comfortably in this hall and with our lifestyles, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And on that front, one of the things that we badly need is really good art that starts to make it real. Now, I'm happy to be able to announce to anyone in the room who doesn't know that you are someone who's been making some of that art. This is Steve Waters, the playwright, has done some very interesting stuff around climate change through drama. We need a lot more of that. We need it to look unabashedly at what's likely to happen. We need it across all media, including mass media. That means we very badly need it in film and television, where we've had virtually none of it to date. If we're trying to think about kind of realistic ways in which we can imagine what's likely to be coming, I think that so far the arts have not done well on this front. And in particular, television has almost completely failed. I think that's probably a lot for political reasons. As well as a sort of lack of imagination, perhaps. So, yeah, we need to find ways of being able to do things that we're not very good at doing as humans, especially in this culture, thinking long-term, imagining profound change. Machiavelli says somewhere that human beings can never really understand anything until they've experienced it. Well, if that's true, then we're in a hell of a lot of trouble, and there seems to be a fair amount of truth to it, because we have to anticipate this ahead of time, partly because of one of the awful aspects of the challenge of dangerous climate change is the time lags that are systematically built into it. You know, if we were going to tackle this, if we were going to actually get a grip on it, we would have done so a generation ago. You know, roughly speaking, we would have elected green governments everywhere in the world a generation ago, and they would have done things that were quite unpalatable to a lot of us, and we didn't. Right. So now we're in a kind of real last chance saloon, arguably quite a lot more last chancey than the 1.5 degree IPCC report lets on. And we have to find ways of making that real to ourselves. Again, somebody who can help here is Joanna Macy. Some of the exercises in the work that Reconnects are very much about projecting yourself into the future, which can be very powerful.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I was just kind of wondering what sort of radical changes could we possibly make that might allow that to happen, such as I've heard about really widespread rewilding or radically cutting population growth rates. Yeah. I just wanted to hear your opinion.
Yeah, good. So I haven't said much about that, partly because, you know, lots of other people have said lots about that. I'll briefly say a bit more, and then I'll say a little bit more about why I haven't said more about it. So, yeah, the examples you gave are good. I think it's very clear that we need to find humane ways of reducing the human population. Of course, it's true that the populations in the richer countries are the ones which it's far more important to reduce. So traditionally, advocates of population reduction have focused on countries like Africa and India. That's actually kind of the wrong end of the telescope. The most important countries to reduce populations in are countries like this one and the United States and Australia and Kuwait. But I think that systematic rewilding done cleverly with an eye to kind of mitigation and sequestration is absolutely clearly part of what we need to do. We need to restore genuine biodiverse ecosystems and oppose the culture of monoculture, which is one of the reasons why the geoengineering solutions, which are most popular, are potentially catastrophic. They would be a sort of massive expansion of the drive towards biofuels and palm oil and so on that we've already seen. We would need to have massive institutional change. So as Cornelia said at the start, I've been writing a lot about the precautionary principle. We should really adopt the precautionary principle. We should adopt it around the world. We should act on it really, really seriously. I've also argued that we need to change our democratic systems to include, to build in long-termism into them and to build in care for future generations into them. And I mentioned earlier also another important thing, which is a massive reduction in the amount of animal flesh that we consume in particular. Basically, we need to abolish factory farming of animals, and actually we need to abolish factory farming in total. The real underlying problem is not animal agriculture, it's industrial agriculture. And industrial agriculture includes animal agriculture as its most cruel and horrible and destructive element. But if you just switch from eating beef raised on soy to eating the soybeans directly, you're still not doing much for the planet if the soybeans you're eating directly were grown where there was previously Amazon rainforest. So these are some of the big things that we need to do. But now a brief word about why I didn't say more about these things. It's not just that everyone else has been saying loads about them, or lots of other people. It's also that I think that the way that people have focused on these things so much has not enabled us to look clearly in the face enough what is coming. You know, I think if we spend all our time talking about these radical transformational solutions, especially when we realize that, you know, yeah, absolutely, let's try and make them happen. And the wonderful thing about human beings is that our agency and our powers are never known to us before we've tried, you know. There can be extraordinary tipping points in human culture and human thinking and so on, which are completely unpredictable before. And that's why it's premature. Anybody who says, we are doomed, we are all going to go extinct or something, you know, no, that's not it. There are definitely going to be more animal extinctions, and there is a possibility of human extinction. But the idea of the Extinction Rebellion is to stop as many extinctions as we possibly can. And we don't know yet what the limits are to how successful we can be at that. But if we spend all our time thinking about these radical transformations, then we're not spending any of our time actually looking in the face the likelihood that we're going to fail. Or at least we're not spending any of our time preparing for the possibility of failure. Let me put it even no more strongly than that. We have to prepare for the possibility of failure. It is absolutely unacceptable that, for example, in the name of stopping dangerous climate change, we're building nuclear power stations, which are going to be the most terrible liabilities for future generations if civilization does collapse. It's radically unacceptable. So we have to think about these things as well. It's not enough to think about the transformations we want to make.
Thank you so much. Will you please all just join me in raising a final hand for Dr. Rupert Read?
And thank you.
That was the conclusion of an hour-long program based on Rupert Read's talk, This Civilization is Finished. So what is to be done? Filmed at Churchill College, University of Cambridge, UK, on November 7, 2018. Dr. Rupert Read is teaching philosophy at the University of East Anglia, UK, and he's a longtime Green Party politician. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.